Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Benjamin Vogt. He's an author and garden designer who lives in Nebraska. He has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He owns Monarch Gardens LLC, a prairie garden design company in eastern Nebraska, and speaks nationally on garden design and landscape ethics at conferences and seminars. He's the author of a very, very good book called A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
It's so fantastic to speak with you.
Oh, thanks. So the first question is, what is a tall grass prairie?
Tall grass prairie is, you know, there are all kinds of different prairie, different grassland ecosystems. Here in the United States, we basically have three grassland ecosystems, and the tall grass, obviously means that it's tall grass. So we're talking, grasses that are 6 feet tall, 8 feet tall, things like Indian grass, big blue stem, and that region historically started in eastern Nebraska, eastern Oklahoma, eastern Dakotas, and then went across Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, and a little bit into Illinois, a little bit into Indiana. So that was the historic range of the tall grass, and it received more rain than the mixed grass prairie, which is just to the west of the tall grass going down to the middle of the country, and that had a mix of short and tall grasses. So you'd have the big blue stem, but then you'd also have the little blue stem. So something that's, you know, 2 or 3 feet tall. And then we have the short grass, prairies, which is everything west going up to the Colorado Rockies, basically. And that was stuff that's, you know, a foot or two all the way down to just a couple of inches. And those short grass areas would receive a lot less, rain, which is why the grasses are so much shorter. So I don't know if that's a good explanation, but there it is.
So, you mentioned how tall the sort of medium height ones are. How tall were the tallest grasses?
Yeah, you know, we're talking probably 6 to 8 feet if they're getting plenty of rain and they're in full bloom. Of course, we have forbs in those prairies that were a lot taller. Compass plants can be like 12 feet or even up to 14 feet tall. So we had a lot of flowers that were, you know, maybe as twice as tall as the grasses.
I've read accounts of, like, people on the Oregon Trail who they would be riding horses, and the grass would come up very high. They would not be able to see much over the grass. Or they would also, I've read stories of the wind blowing across it would make them feel seasick. So these grasses were just, I mean, give us a little bit more of an idea of how tall that is to walk through a field of grass that's 6 feet tall.
Well, I mean, maybe folks listening have walked through a cornfield or something. Corn is a type of grass. So, I mean, you know, for me, walking through a prairie is so much more comforting than walking through a forest or a woodland, because those trees, you know, you're talking trees that are 100 feet tall, and whenever I'm in a forest, I feel really, I don't know, I feel very cloistered and afraid, and like something's going to come out and jump and get me. But in a prairie, even though I can't necessarily always see over the grasses, if I'm lucky, I feel like there's this sort of, it feels very womb-like to me. I feel very comforted and warm. But, you know, there was an account of Coronado, the Spanish conquistador, who came up, God, what century was that? Do you remember, was that the 1400s?
No, it would have been the 16th or 17th century.
You're right. So, you know, they were coming up from, Arizona, New Mexico, and they went up into central Kansas, and they were leaving huge tree poles behind them so that they could find their way through the tall grass, because the grasses were, you know, up to their thighs on their horses.
And so what has happened to the tall grass prairie? What percentage is left? How and why was it destroyed?
These are all depressing things, but that's okay. We have to go into this. There are, you know, depending on what study you read, it'd be something like 97% to 99% of the tall grass is gone. And then you go to the mixed grass prairies, and that's 70% gone. And then you go to short grass, and that's 30% to 50% is gone. And all of our United States grasslands, about 70% of them are predicted to be gone by 2100. So we're really running out of time to conserve them and preserve them. So going back a little bit, let's talk a little bit about that tall grass prairie loss, especially because the farm belt, you know, where the most productive cropland is
wait.
Where the tall grass is. What?
Wait, I'm sorry, before we go there, this is my fault for not asking questions in the right order, but we talked about grasses, but before we talk about their destruction, can you talk more about who else lives there besides grass?
Well, just humans anymore.
I'm talking about before. Like, what are the relationships? I know prairie dogs live in short grass prairie. Did they also live in tall grass prairie? Did buffalo live in tall grass prairie? Who else lived in, who else made up the community?
We had bison. Certainly grassland birds. And grassland birds are the most threatened group of birds right now in the country. And they certainly had their home in the tall grass, especially the prairie pothole region up there in North Dakota, South Dakota. Everything. I mean, snakes and turtles and even fish going to the creeks and all kinds of amphibians and butterflies and moths. We all know about monarch butterflies right now, and their main breeding area in the Midwest and really in the United States is Iowa, southern Minnesota, Wisconsin, northern Illinois, exactly where the tall grass prairie used to be. So now we don't have that tall grass anymore, and we have this dwindling number of monarch butterflies. So, and that's just one species, right? So, I mean, the list of species is in the hundreds and thousands as far as fauna, if we're talking about fauna, that were living in symbiosis with the tall grass and the forbs and the flowers that were there.
And another thing that's very important about prairies is the soil. That what I've read is that the soil was sometimes, to our minds, unbelievably deep. Can you talk about that just a little bit before we talk about destruction?
Incredibly deep, because these prairie grasses and prairie forbs have roots that are going down 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, maybe even 18 to 20 feet deep. And if you think something like, big blue stem. So you take a square yard on the surface, a big blue stem on the surface of the tall grass prairie, and you just go down into the ground as far as you can, you're looking at 320 miles of roots. Or 320 feet of roots just in that square yard of big blue stem. So you have all these roots going down, you know, amending the soil. And with our prairie grasses, one third of the roots die each year. So those dead roots are going to naturally decay. Soil organisms are going to eat them up and for lack of a better term, poop them out and create wonderfully rich black organic soils that are perfect for raising commodity crops.
Which leads us directly into how the grasslands were harmed.
Pretty much right there. Yep. It's great soil for producing corn and soybeans and wheat. I always have to stop and check myself when I'm talking about prairie, because I am totally aware that my family was part of the sod busting phenomenon, and it was the mixed grass prairie down in Oklahoma, which wasn't too far from the tall grass on the eastern side. My family homesteaded in the western part of Oklahoma, where it was especially hot and windy, but they homesteaded on land that had just recently been Cheyenne and Arapaho reservation land, and they did plow up all the sod, and I have those stories, and I have my own family remembering living there in sod houses. We were talking about that just before we started this formal interview, about how your great grandmother or something?
Yes, it was my great grandmother lived in a sod house on the prairie in Nebraska.
This stuff is really close to us. This history is really close to us, like we were saying. And so every time I talk about the prairie, I'm thinking, gosh, you know, how do I honor my family who came over from Russia and Germany and sacrificed so much that I can't even possibly imagine? And yet they also helped to eradicate countless animal and plant cultures. They came here to be liberated, to express their own Mennonite faith, and yet they destroyed, in a lot of respects, the faith of all kinds of species.
Yeah, you know, I think often about a species that was eradicated in the late 19th century through sod busting, which is the American locust. that it, in the 1870s, I believe it was, had the largest single conglomeration of animals ever observed, in that it was a swarm of locusts that was like hundreds of, I don't know, just thousands and thousands of square miles, and just, I don't know, I'm making up the numbers, but, you know, millions of tons of biomass or something. And within 20 years, because of plowing, they'd been completely driven extinct.
Yeah, I've got stories passed down from my family where those locusts would be coming through western Oklahoma and Kansas, where they first settled, and they would just eat everything in their path, the crops, all the clothes, the leather saddles on the horses, everything that you can imagine. And yeah, it was just a matter of decades, as is the case with everything, bison, prairie dogs, everything was just a matter of decades. It went so fast.
So, before we go on about this destruction, there's two different directions I want to go. One of them is I want to ask a question I should have asked before, which is, I was in Kentucky doing a talk a few years ago, and somebody took me to see a canebrake, which I'd never seen before, and I was very, very moved. I thought it was beautiful. And are canebrakes a form of tallgrass prairie, or is that a different thing?
I don't even know what a canebrake is.
A canebrake is they're a tall grass, kind of like a bamboo thing.
Okay.
And they were further east than you're talking about, and they would be, it's like a forest of 10 or 12 foot tall grasses. But I guess they're a little bit east. So anyway, the next question is, another thing I've heard about a lot that was very destructive of these prairies is tile drainage. And that's where they would put in tiles to actually drain essentially drain the groundwater. And that was another significant cause of harm to the prairies and wetlands, of course. And, you know, maybe, is there anything you want to say about that too, or should we go on?
Let's go on, because, you know, I'm thinking about drainage, and I'm thinking about glyphosate, and I'm thinking about those sorts of things. And if you want to go that way, we can, but.
Oh, sure. The only thing I was really wondering about the tile drainage, is that a lot of the problems that we've seen, like the plowing, that could be remedied over time by stopping plowing. And I don't know how to remedy the tiles that have already been put in to drain a wetland.
I don't know either. Nope.
Yeah, that seems a problem. Anyway, so we'll move on. So you were talking about plowing and sod busting. And then can you move on with with more of the destruction of these habitats?
Well, what way do you want me to go, Derek?
Well, I want you to go whatever direction you want to go.
We're sitting here talking about soil. So we've got all these monocultures, right? We have the corn and the soybeans mostly here in the tallgrass prairie region of Nebraska and Iowa, and that region is creeping north with climate change. So South Dakota is getting in on the corn action now. But we're using all this glyphosate, all this Roundup, right? So we have this wonderful chemical that specializes in adhering to the minerals in the soil. Which is fantastic. That's one of its selling points, and why farmers like it. So it's adhering to the minerals, so it's not going to wash away when it rains. The problem is, what it's doing is it's killing all the soil life, all the microbial life, so that you're basically creating a dead soil that becomes a hard pan. And whenever it rains, all that water just washes off, washes away, washes in the Mississippi, washes down to the Gulf of Mexico. There is a way to remedy this, and it actually increases crop production. And that's, have you heard of the STRIPS program out of Iowa State?
Tell me about it.
Okay, yeah, that's good. We should. Iowa State University has a program called STRIPS. I can't remember what STRIPS stands for. It's so complicated, all these acronyms. But basically, what they're doing is they're having some really good results on some farmland in central Iowa, where they are placing strategic strips of prairie, so grasses, tall grass, and forbs, in farm fields in specific places, you know, maybe the bottom of hills, something, so that they can slow down erosion. And so what's happening is the soil loss is down by 90%, fertilizer loss is down by 90%, because these tall grass strips are capturing everything and keeping it on site. And of course, that has the added benefit of hopefully supporting a little bit of wildlife, certainly pollinators. I don't know how much it's going to do for larger fauna. Probably not much because it's not a very large area, these strips, you know, maybe a couple dozen feet wide or something. So there is a way, and you know, it doesn't cost very much money and it doesn't eat into a farmer's revenue to have these strips. In fact, it probably increases it because they're having to use less chemicals, less fertilizers, less insecticides and pesticides when they have these prairie strips on their farms. So it's very promising research. It's, you know, it's holistic. It works.
That reminds me of two phrases. One is, I used to be a commercial beekeeper, and a fairly famous line among beekeepers is that you get 90% of your honey from about 10% of the land, by which they mean you get most of your honey from fence rows, because nobody mows them. That was one part. And the other is that, we mentioned my grandmother, my great grandmother earlier, and my mother has talked often about a change in farming over the past, since she was a child in the 30s, is that back in the 30s it was absolutely routine for farmers to leave a certain percentage of their land for the geese. And so that, I mean, I don't remember the exact phrase, but it's basically one ear of corn for me, one ear of corn for the raccoons, and one ear of corn for the geese. And that, with the consolidation of farming and with the, sort of monetization or stricter monetization, I guess we could say, that has often, a lot of those edges and rows have been put to economic use.
Well, you know, when corn prices were up, I guess that was about a decade ago, corn prices were up around $8 a bushel or something, and now I think they're around $3 or $4 a bushel, but when they were up really high, of course, farmers wanted to make as much money as they could, totally understandable, so they took out, they went as far to the edge as they possibly could, almost all the way to the road. Maybe you'd have 10 feet left or 6 feet left on the edge of the country road. And then, of course, hedgerows started coming down. Wonderful habitat right there for all kinds of wildlife, including our native bee species, our 4,000 native bee species. And then, you know, trees came down. The windbreaks came down. So we're going to be looking at, who knows, another dust bowl coming up here in the next couple of decades because we don't have these trees that we planted after the 1930s to help stop erosion and stop that wind from just sweeping down the plain, as the song goes.
So let's switch topics a little bit and talk about gardens. And you talk about a new garden ethic, and in your book you do say things like, gardens by default are already problematic, and you talk about gardens being places of alienation, and at the same time, of course, you know, you work with them. So why are gardens problematic?
Gardens are problematic for the very fact that we are basically taking, I think of plants and animals as having their own cultures. So we're taking these other cultures and we're bringing them into our own, but we're remaking, reshaping, and reorganizing these cultures in ways that are primarily aesthetically appealing to us. We think this specific plant looks pretty right here, and we think it looks pretty next to this plant here, so that's how we're going to put our garden together. More and more, where landscape designers and garden designers are thinking more about ecology and how the plants are supporting life above and below the soil line, and how gardens are connected to wilder areas, if there are wilder areas near the garden. So we're basically imposing our human privilege on these plants and other organisms without really understanding how they work, what their language is, what they need to survive and thrive, and how these small patches of landscape are actually going to maybe, hopefully, at least create islands of refuge for species that are vanishing in a time of mass extinction.
So what do you, you have talked about why they're problematic. Can you talk about, I was really struck by your use of the word alienation, because a lot of times people don't perceive gardens in that way. And I love what you're saying, and I think it's really, really important. But can you talk a little bit about what you mean by alienation there?
I think there's a lot going on because it really, it certainly is a complex topic, and there's so many emotions and there's so much psychology at play here, but we live in a culture right now that is totally alienated from nature. We have kids growing up who can't name trees, who can't name bird calls. I used to teach English and take my students outside on the campus to do writing exercises, and I just asked, what is that? And they couldn't say it's a blue jay or robin, birds that are very common, and they're going to be very common for a long time. So we have this, when we go into our gardens, I think we're using these plants that we're just not familiar with because we haven't grown up familiar with nature. Most of us haven't, right? 70% of us live in cities now, or soon live in cities where there is very little wild nature. There's very, very little life other than human life. So we're unable to recognize the languages that are around us, or even to understand that these languages are okay to have around us and perhaps beneficial, even if we don't necessarily understand what's being said. Now, when you come down to the garden level, you're being asked to be even more intimate with these languages, with these other plant species and these animal species, and really try to start to understand them. And if you're not doing that, I don't feel like you're really gardening. I know that sounds kind of harsh, but for me, the act of designing a garden, putting a garden in, it's far more than creating just an aesthetic appeal to humans' visual senses or oral senses or whatever. We're really trying to revive a wildness that we've gotten away from, and the further we get away from it, the more psychological damage we're doing to ourselves. So that was wordy. How else can I be wordy?
No, it's great. And I love and agree with what you're saying about plant cultures and various non-human cultures and non-human languages. That sort of thought is alien and blasphemous to many people in this culture. So can you talk more about these cultures and languages, please?
So we all love the smell. I'm sure we do all love the smell of a freshly mown lawn in the summer. It's just this nostalgic scent. We're thinking about carefree childhood days where you're playing barefoot on the lawn. But that scent of cut lawn is actually the lawn screaming out with volatile organic compounds, screaming out to the environment around it, I am being damaged, I am being injured, I am being hurt. Hey, plants around me, you need to put up your defenses and produce whatever chemicals you need to so you're not also going to be damaged or eaten. So plants are doing that type of communication all the time. Plants talk to each other also through their root zones. Trees communicate with each other in all kinds of sorts of specialized ways that I can't even possibly get into, but there's so many wonderful books on that topic. They're readily available. And of course, animals talk to each other. We hear these animal calls all the time. I remember hearing a fox. I think it was last year or something. I had no idea. I'd never heard a fox call before, and I was 41. I mean, that's ridiculous. I'd never heard a fox call. I didn't know what it was. It was at first terrifying, and then of course, being the 21st century human I am, I went on to YouTube and figured out it was a fox and thought, okay, you know, I'm understanding that this world is around me, and this is awesome. Once you start to understand what another species is saying, but that they're just, that's just their language, you become comfortable with it and almost joyful with it. It's like when you travel, you're experiencing all these other human cultures, and your culture becomes enriched by it just sort of through osmosis.
This reminds me of something that John Livingston would talk about, how we think of cities as places of sensory overload. And I know when I go to a city, you know, when I get to my hotel, I just have to pull the drapes shut, turn off the lights, and try to recover because of all the sharp edges and all the humans and everything else. It's too much. But at the same time, he said that they're actually not places of sensory overload, but rather places of sensory deprivation. Because when you think about it, basically every sensory perception that we have is either created by or mediated by humans. And so what we are is in a gigantic echo chamber. And I'm just reflecting that back as to what you just said about. And then a garden would be, as you said, an attempt to impose human order onto this non-human order.
Yeah, we have a tendency to see nature as very disordered and very chaotic, right? But if we have mathematicians listening, we know that everything is a fractal. Clouds are fractals, sunflowers are fractals, coastlines are fractals. So everything is a mathematical equation, which in some way gives us sort of a sense of peace and understanding that the world isn't out to get us. It isn't this totally random jumble of pieces. There is this synchronicity, right? Everything has its place, and as Aldo Leopold said, we need to leave as many pieces as we can because that's what intelligent tinkering is, and we're not very intelligent tinkerers right now. So
what is the relationship between gardening and perceiving these non-human cultures, and of course not necessarily understanding them, because for crying out loud, somebody could be speaking Croatian in front of me, and I wouldn't understand that either. But perceiving these other languages and critical thinking.
Critical thinking, that's pretty rare in our culture these days. When I used to teach college English, that was like the number one goal. How can we think critically about things? And critical thinking means not taking everything so personally and not thinking that everything is an attack on you. So if somebody advocates for native plants, native plant gardens, it's not an attack on your value system. It might be a subtle attack on your belief system, because that's just how you interpret it. But it's asking us to think, hey, these garden spaces are not just for us, right? We are just one species of God knows how many species on this planet. And if we're not thinking about what other species need, then really ultimately we're not thinking what we need to thrive and survive. So I guess if we have to think about it that narrowly, that's fine. You know, I'm going to do this for me, but really I like us to be thinking, how do we do it for others?
So let's take a progression of gardening or landscaping styles, starting with sort of a monoculture lawn that's of a non-native grass, and then move through. So at some point there might be, I mean, from there there's, you know, vegetable gardening, there's some flower gardening, and then from there there's some butterfly gardening, and then let's keep moving through steps. Do you see what I'm trying to ask?
No, but, you know, that's probably because I have a newborn baby and it keeps me up at night.
So let's move. You're talking about a new garden ethic. So let's talk about the sort of old garden ethic. You've talked about some, and talk about sort of the classic example would be the green lawn of Kentucky bluegrass that doesn't belong in a redwood forest or doesn't belong in Nebraska. And then move from there through the stages toward the new garden ethic, and use concrete, but that's a terrible word here.
No, yes.
use tangible examples of how a person who has a lawn and they don't really want a lawn, they want to follow this new garden ethic, sort of move through steps toward each one is a more, nature-based garden.
I got you. So we're talking prescriptive. Okay.
Yes.
So start small. Don't be like me and be crazy and convert half your lot at one time, because you'd just be overwhelmed, even though it's terribly exciting. So I live on a quarter acre lot and went gangbusters. But you can just start with, you know, most people start with foundation beds, maybe on the side of their house. Maybe they have a 6 foot deep foundation bed or something that stretches 10 or 20 feet. And you can just start experimenting with the plants there. I always, when I'm giving talks, I always tell, especially to newbie people, I say, look, just plant an aster, plant a goldenrod. When these plants are in bloom, sit out there for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and just watch what's coming on a sunny day, and you'll be hooked. I mean, that'll be it. It's a very slippery slope once you start watching what's coming and how much diversity is coming. You'd be like, God, what else can I put in my garden? Okay, this bed clearly isn't big enough, so maybe I'm going to double the depth now. It's no longer 6 feet deep, it's 12 feet deep. And I was reading about how oak trees are the number one tree to support the larval stages of so many insects, so I'm going to put an oak tree in. And then you know, while I'm doing the oak tree, maybe I'll put in a maple tree, an elm tree. Those are some of the other good trees. And then you start thinking shrubs. And before you know it, you're building this multi-leveled, multi-tiered habitat that maybe it's going around the edge of your property and it just slowly creeps in and takes over everything. And a couple years ago, I had about 3 or 4,000 square feet of lawn left in my backyard, and I never mowed it. Hated the darn thing. Hate the mow, period. But never watered it, never fertilized it, so it was very drought riddled in August and lots of bare spots. And I just decided I'm going to scalp this thing in the fall, and I'm going to throw down a bunch of prairie seed, maybe do 100, 200 prairie flower plugs and just see what happens. And now I've got what I think is just quite a delightful meadow out back that just requires one mowing in the spring when I cut it down before all the new growth comes up in the spring. So, you
know. And do you see, and what fauna do you see in your little meadow there?
Strangely right now, and I'll give you more examples, but right now I've got this little baby bunny that's been hanging around the whole summer. I've been watching it slowly grow up. And the interesting thing is, it's not eating any of my plants. I'm always talking to people who are like, how do I keep rabbits from eating all my plants down? And what happens, what's going on is that these folks have garden beds where you have a plant. Here's their prized hydrangea or something. And then 3 feet away, here's their other prized plant. So you have this very unnatural ecosystem going on where their plants are spread far apart. There's probably a lot of mulch in between them. And so there's really, the bunny has a couple plant choices. And of course they're going to go for the obvious plant choices. Now when you have 100 or 500 or 1,000 plants in your backyard garden, there's just too many plants for the rabbit to eat, and you're never going to notice the damage that they're causing. But anyway, this silly little rabbit, it's not eating any of my plants. It's eating the last few hundred square feet of lawn I have in the backyard. I think it's the universe telling me that I need to rip up the rest of the lawn, because it's just going to town on that green lawn. But so yeah, we have the orb weaver spiders have been fantastic the last 2 years. Those yellow banded spiders, and then the other orb weavers, they're everywhere. The last 2 years, I think I've seen actually a decline in pollinator species and diversity. There just hasn't been as many bees and wasps and butterflies and flies and beetles and all that stuff. But that might be because some of the grasses in my backyard are taking over the flowers, which is exactly what a prairie ecosystem is supposed to do. So if I was not in city limits, I would burn the thing down like a person should every couple of years. But I can't do that. So the Lincoln City inspector said I can't burn in city limits, so I'm stuck. I had a sharp-shinned hawk a couple years ago who made the most glorious clean kill on a chickadee in the backyard. There was no blood or anything, just a couple of feathers, and that was pretty cool to see. I'm trying to, whenever you have a landscape that's geared towards wildlife, you want to think about edge habitat and tiered habitats. You have overstory trees and understory trees and shrubs, which are creating hedgerows. And then you have tall flowers and grasses. And then you have shorter flowers and grasses. And then you have ground covers, because that way you'll be appealing to a much greater diversity of fauna in your landscape than if you just have what most people have, which is the same sort of size plants and the same few plants in a straight line and a thin bed at the front of your house.
And to be very clear, you're not talking about a huge amount of land here.
No, absolutely. I mean, maybe to some people, my quarter acre lot sounds like a lot. I have clients who are on an acre or two, but no, I mean, you can even do this, you can do this in a few hundred square feet. You don't have to be the crazy plant person in your neighborhood if you don't want to be.
And if you were to shorten your garden ethic to one phrase or one sentence, what would it be?
In a time of mass extinction and climate change, how and for whom we garden matters more than ever.
And I think that's really beautiful. And how then, let's go back to prairies themselves for a while. First off, you mentioned burning. Can you talk about obviously not in your backyard garden, but in a in a prairie-wide scale area, what's the role of fire in a tallgrass prairie?
Fire is especially important in the tallgrass prairie because you know, a lot of, you know, the tall grass is a budding basically forest and woodlands. So you've got forests wanting to come west and invade on the tall grass prairies. And if you have even one tree on 1,000 acres, you're basically the grassland bird species aren't going to want to be there because that tree is going to harbor hawks and other predators, so they don't want to be around there. So fire is going to eradicate tree saplings, shrub saplings that you don't want to be there. And of course, fire is also going to rejuvenate the plants. And the nutrients that are left behind after fire is going to help the soil rejuvenate. And then when you're burning back all those grasses, you're creating open black areas and open areas of soil, which are going to absorb the solar energy, and all the flower seeds that are sitting there at the soil surface or just below the soil surface are going to have a chance to germinate and be able to compete with the grasses at least for a couple of years until you have to burn again when the grasses start to outcompete the flowers.
We're going to jump back again to gardens, and can you talk just a little bit about, you mentioned in your bio that you're a prairie garden design company, and I don't mean for this to be an infomercial, but so what do you do for people? You talked about what you do for yourself. What do you do for other people?
I'm trying just to bring them whatever little echo of the prairie that I can into their daily lives. And that might be just a few hundred square feet. That might be thousands of square feet. That might be an acre or two. So I'm trying basically just to revive what was here before, because you can never rebuild it, right? I mean, the tall grass in Lincoln, Nebraska is gone forever. It's never coming back. And even if some semblance of it comes back, if there's Indian grass and big blue stem growing here, it is never going to be the same prairie that it was. So I'm trying to get them basically to see, you know, number one, of course, the beauty of the native plants, because there is that aesthetic. That's the number one way we approach nature is, oh, is that beautiful? Oh, does that move me emotionally? Do I find that pretty? But then I also, thinking when I'm putting these plants together, okay, what fauna are they going to support? What birds, what butterflies, what moths, what spiders are probably going to come into here that hopefully the people can, the homeowners can interact with and learn to appreciate. And hopefully, I mean, the goal always is when you do a garden like this that you get people to think not just locally, but start to spread out to the state, to the country, and think globally and think, okay, I've seen what my garden of native plants does. I see what this small prairie echo, this small wildlife refuge, this remnant, that this rebuilt island can do for wildlife. Now, what happens when I go to my city council and I say, hey, we need to think about the way we manage the city park. Do we have to be mowing it so often? Why can't this area be a sown meadow? Or why are we mowing our county roads and our highway edges so religiously, and especially at the wrong times, like in June and July, when bird species and butterfly species are reproducing? So, and you can start. So it's hopefully a cascade effect. I mean, a lot of my clients are already invested in issues of climate change and mass extinction, but some of them aren't. And I know their neighbors aren't either, just by looking at their landscapes, because we're creating really radical landscapes, things that used to be here not long ago, but that we're so not used to anymore. It's just totally unfamiliar, and so it's totally scary and frightening.
You know, this all reminds me of a person who brought me to do a talk in Western Illinois. He loves prairies, and first he took me to the only never plowed prairie in his county, which was in between a parking lot and a warehouse, and it was only a couple of acres, but still I couldn't stop crying at how beautiful it was. And by the way, even though it's tiny, there was a goose nesting in this little area.
Sure, yeah.
And then after that, he took me out to the country where he has been helping the prairie to, I know you said that it can't come back as it was, but he has been doing tons of restoration work there. And it was again, really extraordinarily stunning. And so recognizing that, the Eskimo curlews are gone forever, and that for now the prairie dogs have been pushed out, and the American locusts are gone forever. Recognizing that, what can people who care about, how can we help the prairie as much as possible? And now we're jumping back away from gardens, and we're going to larger spaces.
So it's all a garden, Derek. I mean, there's not one square inch of this planet that is not now a garden, right? We've affected everything just by the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere. So this entire planet is a garden now, right? So how are we going to manage it? How are we going to cultivate it? Is it going to be from a human-centric perspective? Or are we going to start to include other species perspectives? And then, you know, how's that going to grow? So, God, I'm trying to remember what you originally asked me now a minute ago, but.
Well, what I'm asking is, what can those of us who care about wild nature, and especially since we're talking about prairies, what can those of us who care about, tall grass prairie do to help? See, here's the thing, is that I love what Paul Stamets says about how nature loves a community. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. where I live here in the redwood forests, what I have had to do to help the redwood forest recover is, for the most part, leave it alone. Mm-hmm. And actually to kick people off. And that has done wonders to new trees coming up, to everything has done wonderfully. And so I'm wondering what on a larger scale, can be done to help. Like, okay, here's the thing. Say somebody was really rich, or say the government got involved and you could do something at a landscape level. You've talked about what you can do at a neighbor level. Now on a landscape level, what would you want to do to help the, you know, if somebody gave you access to 100,000 acres, what would be your prescriptions to try to help the tall grass prairie who lived there before come back as best it could?
Derek, I would seed the crap out of it with tall grass seed. That's exactly where you start. I dream of having an acreage of my own. 40 acres would be great. 20 is probably more affordable. But the first thing I would do, I would hope to actually get a previous cornfield and then heal it by casting as much prairie seed as I can and then observing what's happening. Because, you know, I have tall grass prairie friends who manage thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of acres. And now they've got exotic plants moving in, right? But they're okay with some of them as long as they're not invasives, because nature wants to fill that gap in, right? And so, I mean, I think about that in our gardens. We have all these barren spots of mulch between our plants, but nature abhors a vacuum. So how can we start to embrace all the different species that are moving in that we brought in and still have a semblance of a functioning tall grass prairie, even though it might not be 100% native plants? I don't know. It's tricky.
So we have just a few minutes left, and that's what I would like for you to walk through, is your fantasy scenario, of, let's say somebody gave you 120 acres, 100 acres, whatever, and it's cornfield. It's nothing but either corn or wheat field right now. So basically you're working with bare ground. Walk us through your fantasy of how many years it takes just walk us through your fantasy of the next several years.
Oh, I'm salivating here, Derek. Come on.
You bet.
Getting me going, getting me riled up. I think I want to spend at least a year, part of a year, just trying to understand the landscape, the way the water drains, the way the wind blows, what species might be currently using the space right now. Just so I can start to get in tune with the landscape, even though it's going to be radically altered. And then I want to make sure that I'm understanding what prairie grasses and flowers were here before and what prairie grasses and flowers still might be on the margin of my 120 acres. How do I bring those in? How many do I bring in? I bring in all of my wonderful prairie guru friends and all of my soil ecology guru friends and we just have a nice, I don't know, campfire and beer powwow or something, I don't know, and talk about how we're going to heal this landscape and revive it. Because 120 acres, I mean, that on a hard, on this huge, you know, North American scale, it's as insignificant as 100 square feet on somebody's quarter acre lot in suburbia. I mean, insignificant from an ecological standpoint, right? It's not doing that much good. It needs to be 120,000 acres or something. But at the same point, at the same time, it's calling us home and it's calling other species home. And all the species that still depend on tallgrass prairie, I mean, that did depend on tallgrass prairie, they're still here. They're still among us. They've just been marginalized and shrunk, but they're all still here. So how do we help them?
So I have a friend who just put in, this is in Northern California, who just put in, what's it called? Blue diamond needle, I don't know. It's a tall grass from California who just threw some out just this year. And, just in 1 year, it's extraordinary how many, first off, grasshoppers are there. And second, how many birds have come to eat the grasshoppers. And this is just in 1 year.
Well, yeah, and that's probably not going to continue because, you know, grasshoppers like to lay their eggs in open soil, warm open soil. So the grasshopper numbers will probably just naturally go down, and maybe the bird species who eat those grasshoppers might go down. That's a guess.
Well, and the point here is that you know that. So we have like 2 minutes left. So walk people through. You've had your campfire, and now you put in some bluegrass or some bluestem grass, and what else? What happens over the next 10 years?
We're going to watch and see what happens. Obviously, we're going to manage for an invasive species like musk thistle or purple loosestrife or something that might pop up in there, because we want to make sure that we're giving all these native plants a chance to thrive and grow and reproduce. So we're just going to pay attention to what the plants tell us, where they want to move, because the plants are going to move just as they do in a smaller garden. They're going to tell us where they want to be, and the species that come in to use that space are going to tell us what they want and how they want to use the space, and we can slowly tailor that over 10 years. You know, a tall grass prairie it's going to be decades and decades and decades before it's even remotely fully functional or partly functional for the environment. I think it's like a 20-year-old prairie might absorb 9-inch rainfall in an hour. But it's going to take that long to heal the soils, especially if it was a former cornfield. Those roots are going to take decades to amend that soil and create those airways and passageways for water to penetrate down into the soil. So it takes a long time. It's like planting a tree, right? You're supposed to plant a tree now so your grandkids can enjoy it in the future. Same thing with a prairie.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Benjamin Vogt. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.